It's happy birthday.
It's half past eight, New York time. Time to wake up America and stump the experts. Each week at this time, Lucky Strike presents Information Please. You send in the questions, we set up the experts, and sometimes your questions upset them. For every question we use, Lucky Strike pays out $10 plus a copy of the new Information Please quiz book. If your question stumps us, you get $25 more plus the 24-volume set of the current Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your questions to Information Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. If our editorial staff edits your questions a bit, don't fret over it. In case of duplication, Information Please uses the question that was received first, and all questions become the property of Information Please. And now, light up a lucky strike as I introduce our master of ceremonies, the literary critic of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, the questions that are hurried on Information Please aren't seen in advance by any of the experts, and that's a cast-iron guarantee of a completely ad-lib performance this week and every week. Now, tonight, our board includes the always astonishing composer, pianist, and author, Oscar Levant, the almost unbelievably learned sports expert, Mr. John Kieran, and their equally invaluable colleague, the New York Post's humorous columnist, Franklin P. Adams. Our guest tonight is a famous Harvard anthropologist whose statements and writings are listened to and read outside of academic walls as well as inside, and whose most recent work is Why Men Behave Like Apes and Vice Versa, Professor Ernest Albert Houghton. Now remember, for each question missed, Lucky Strike rings up $25. And that's paid out to the sender, plus 24 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, the first question comes from a gentleman who I think is known to all people who go to the movies, Mr. Jimmy Gleason of Beverly Hills, California. Now, Jimmy has sent us a great many questions that we've rejected because the questions weren't as tough as Jimmy is. But we've finally accepted one. But I want to read you what Mr. Jimmy Gleason says in his letter to us. He begins as follows. Never say die, Gleason. That's me. It ain't the dough, of course, and it ain't the encyclopedia, but I really would like to stick those guys. So we're going to take him at his word and try to stick you guys with the following question from Jimmy. What is the specific verb used to describe the birth of certain domestic animals? Get 3 out of 4. A cow. Is said to what, Mr. Adams?
Is said to calve.
A cow is undoubtedly said to calve. Not by other cows, but by us. That's quite right. A mare. A mare is said to what, Mr. Levant?
Fall or foul, what is it?
Well, make up your mind.
It all depends on the horse.
Well, be decent. It's foal. You have to be fair to mares. To foal, yes. And you also, sometimes we use the word foal of a, or is it an you? Mr. Kieran, do you say A-U or N-U?
A-U.
A-U, unless it's in a crossword puzzle. In which case it, of course, begins with a consonant. Now, how about dog? What does a dog, Mr. Houghton?
Pup.
Well, that's more or less colloquial. Yes, I think pup, but not so colloquially. Mr. Kieran?
Whelp.
To whelp, yes. And I guess you'd say whelp of some beasts of prey, too. Now, what does a sow do? A sow? Mr. LeFant?
No, I was going to make a joke. Let Mr. Kieran do it.
Mr. Kieran?
A farrow.
Yes, farrow. That's another word that's used of pigs, I think, Mr. LeFant.
I was going to say reefs.
Reefs, I get it. Very good. And so early in the program, too. A sow farrows, and on occasion, just to be whimsical, it sometimes litters. That gives us 4 out of 4. Shall we send that encyclopedia to Jimmy Gleason?
No, sir.
No encyclopedia? No $25? No
nothing to Gleason.
Oh, let's send it to him.
Send him a sow.
How about this one? This comes from Mr. R. Webster of Waltham, Massachusetts. Attend carefully, gentlemen. Would it still be possible for Mr. Wendell Willkie to be elected president and Mr. McNary vice president? Would it still be possible for Mr. Willkie to be elected president and Mr. McNary vice president? Mr. Adams?
It would.
Why?
If the electors elected to vote the other way.
Yes. In other words, they do have the privilege of choice even now.
Even now.
That's quite right. Technically, they may vote for whomever they wish.
Yes, sir.
Any bets, Mr. Kieran?
Any bets?
No, not a bet. And when are the electors going to meet? Does any of you know?
Next week.
December.
Next Monday, December 16th. And we'll really know the answer, presumably on Tuesday. Now, Carolyn Schrodes of Stockton, California, sends in this one. Many of us have wanted to achieve immortality, or at any rate, extreme longevity. According to the following people, how would you do it? Get 2 out of 3. According to the author James Hilton, how could you achieve immortality or live a long time? Mr. Levant had his hand up first.
Well, he has a philosophy under his writings, but I won't go into that. He does it geographically by going to some place you can't afford in Indochina.
Well, it's not Indochina, but not too far from
that. Tibet.
Yes. Living state of Nirvana. There's that strange mountain where you meet Margot and Ronald Coleman.
Well, do you think meeting Margot and Ronald Coleman enables you to become immortal, Mr. Levant?
There are 4 or 5 schools of thought on that.
But as you say, what specific thing is it that he...
Lama. There's an old man who talks forever.
Yes, but what makes people live a long time in Tibet, according to Mr. Hilton?
They're purged and cleansed of all sins.
I know, but that doesn't make you live a long time. It makes you live a little dully.
Maybe they smoke Luckies. I don't know.
No, I don't think that's that. Thank you. No, it's simply, I think you were on the right track, Mr. Levant. It's the, Mr. Kieran?
Well, it must be the climate.
Yeah.
In Shangri-La.
That's right. It's the climate. I think Mr. Levant meant climate. Now, how about Mr. George Bernard Shaw's recipe for living a long time? Mr. Adams.
Vegetarianism.
Weeds and water, as someone once said about him. Well, that's his own recipe for living a long time, but if you want to live forever, according to his plays, how do you do it?
Is that Back to Methuselah?
Yes, it is in Back to Methuselah.
It's a very long play, if you recall.
Yes, it is, and it's practically immortal itself.
That was a play he asked them to change the schedules so that people could stay in town overnight and see his play.
Yeah, didn't work. Well, they stayed.
That wouldn't have anything to do with goat glands, would it?
Mr. Houghton?
Wouldn't have anything to do with goat glands,
no,
would
don't
it?
Be hopeful, Mr. Houghton. Nothing to do with goat glands.
In that play, he had a strange idea of birth, I remember, but about death, I don't recall.
Well, that's very nice and optimistic of you. Know, the answer is that he figured that if people just willed to live a long time, they could do so. If you just will to live a long time, you could do so.
That was his principle of birth in that, practically. Eve didn't have Adam, or vice versa, and they just willed and...
And lived an awfully long time. Yes, it's just a matter of volition. That gives us, I think, one wrong. I have to get the next one right. According to Aldous Huxley... How would you achieve immortality or a very long life? According to Aldous Huxley.
That's in that most recent book.
That's correct, Mr. Adams. And what does he say in that most recent book?
I think it was by a diet of...
You're all right so far.
Raw fish.
Yes, but a particular part of the fish. Let's be specific. Just by eating raw fish, you wouldn't live a long time.
The inside of the fish.
Yes, the intestines. Yes, the intestines. If you eat enough viscera...
That's what I meant.
you live a long time. The viscera, particularly of the...
I'm on the delicate side, Mr.
I know, but we have to come clean this evening. Those who wish to find out how to live a long time are urged to read Mr. Huxley's interesting book called After Many a Summer Dies the Swan. Now, that gives us 2 out of 3 and sends us on to a question from Mrs. Elizabeth Williamson. Of Bradford, Pennsylvania. This, I think, is rather tough. We have to make up a baseball team, which means 9 men. A baseball team of animals based on the nicknames of well-known players, past or present. In other words, each player should have a nickname which is the name of an animal. Suppose we, to be systematic, we begin with the infield. Let's get a first base. Mr. Adams? Or any part of the infield.
Fox and Fox.
No.
Infield?
Yeah, he's a...
That's right, that's right. All right, how about second base?
With his nickname or his right name?
His nickname. Oh. Fox is his last name. That isn't really, really... Oh.
I know a nickname for a baseman.
Go ahead.
You would know him. Bobby Brief. He played for Pittsburgh when I was a kid, a very short time.
Is that all right, Mr. Kieran? I wouldn't know. I'm going to ask Mr. Kieran to adjudicate.
Yes,
all right, now we've got one base. Now, how about second, third, and shortstop? How about it, Mr. Adams?
Oh, Rabbit Marin.
For shortstop, that's right. How about second and third, Mr. Levant?
Buck Herzog.
What did he play?
He played second, and he would play anything.
Third base.
Third
Buck?
Base for the general.
Buck, yes. Yeah. You mean a rabbit?
Well, no. Whatever
buck
a buck is,
what
I'm
is
dead.
All right.
Buck in the snow.
Oh, I get it. I get it. Well, you often speak of a rabbit as a buck rabbit. How about third base?
Third base, Buck Weaver. White Sox.
Can't we get away from bucks?
There's time.
Oh, he's got your nose in a buck, Mr. Levant. that gives us a complete infield. Now, how about the outfield? Let's get three on the outfield. Mr. Levant.
Gee, I think I'm wrong. Oh, Ducky Medwick. Oh, he's not an animal.
Yes, he is. Duck is an animal.
Yeah, Ducky Medwick.
You just don't get outside very often, Mr. Levant. Mr. Levant, yes?
Pepper Martin.
Pepper Martin.
Well, a wild horse of Osage.
No, I don't think that's an animal.
Well, a horse is an animal.
Oh, yes, yes, I beg your pardon. Sure, you've got me there. Any others?
Any others? That's pretty good.
It is very good. That gives us only two for the outfield. How about, someone mentioned Goose Goslin?
Oh, no.
How about that?
They should have. Yes, Goose Goslin.
How about another, something like a goose?
Zach Wheat, who was a brother of Buck Wheat.
I think I detect a gag. How about Turkey Mike Donlin? Would that do?
That's a long way to go.
How about catcher and pitcher?
That's easy.
Mr. Kieran.
Give me two hippos. Hippo Vaughn for the pitcher and Hippo Phelps for the catcher.
All right. That. How about Mr. Adams?
Harry the Horse.
Harry the Horse Danny. Well, that gives us our baseball nine. Thank you very much.
I got a good pitcher. Neil Watson.
Oh, that's a very good one. Let's see. It seems to me, though, that we miss on the... On the outfield. We missed one on the outfield. That was a tough one, I admit that.
We missed one outfield.
That sends $25 instead of the Encyclopedia Britannica to Mrs. Williamson of Bradford, Pennsylvania.
And pretty
very tough,
too.
Oh, I think it's a tough question. How about this one from Rose Romano of Detroit? Get you out of three. This will send you back to your mythology, gentlemen, if you have any. What technique did each of the following mythological characters use in winning his lady love? You want to be delicate, Mr. Adams. I can be just as delicate as you can.
I doubt it.
How did Orpheus win Eurydice? Mr. Kieran.
He played on his lute.
He played on his lute, yes. Can you give us the story, Mr. Kieran? What did that do to help him win the lady?
Well, it charmed her.
Yeah, that's right. That's all I wanted to know. I love to hear you say that, that's all. How about Hippomenes in winning Atalanta? What technique did he use, Mr. Hooton?
He caught her up in a race.
How did he do it?
By dropping things that she wanted to pick up.
That's right. What were they?
Apples, I think.
Apples, that's right. Yeah. That's right. We're very precise on this program, Mr. Hooton. That's quite right. And how did Hercules win Dejanira?
First I ever heard of it.
Well, I thought I'd just introduce her on this program, Mr. Adams. Mr. Levant?
I probably lifted up the cave in which she lived.
No. Mr. Hooton?
Well, mostly he strangled people, huh?
Yes, that's right. That's right. You've got Hooton something there.
Took him, dragged him off with the back hair.
Whom did he strangle?
Well, he started off with a couple of snakes as a boyish sport in the cradle.
Well, in this particular case, he strangled her fiancé in one of his appearances. Her fiancé was a fellow who changed form every once in a while. He became he was a snake, and then he strangled him, and he turned himself into a bull, and he got him by the horns. And in this way, he endeared himself to the heart of the Lady Dejanira. All right, what can you do with this one from Mrs. Alan E. French of Hammond, Indiana? Get two out of three. Where in literature or the movies does a monkey or an ape do the following things? Now, Mr. Hooton is somewhat of an authority on apes. He should be able to do very well for us on this question. Where does a monkey or ape commit murder? Commit murder. Mr. Hooton.
I want to pose Mr. Stories, I think, the murder and remorse.
100% correct, Mr. Hooton. That doesn't come under the head of anthropology, does it? Do you read that?
Murder or apes?
Poe.
Poe does, too.
Poe does, too. Very good. And then what can you do with this one? Where does a monkey or ape bring up a boy?
No.
Mr. Levant?
We used to have to pay a dollar for Tarzan. It's in the newspapers for a penny now.
Tarzan, of course. Edgar Rice Burroughs' famous series of stories about Tarzan. And how about this one? Where, in literature or the movies, does a man make a monkey of himself?
That's a rich view.
Now, this is a specific question about a specific book. Miss Kieran.
Well, you don't mean Darwin, do you?
No, I didn't mean Darwin.
You don't mean the hairy ape, do you?
No, don't even mean the hairy ape. Mr. Levant?
Was that Miss Hauer? He does an imitation of
it. Sure, him. That's right.
I don't know what picture it was.
What's the picture called? Remember it?
I think it a lot.
My man, God.
That's good, Mr. Hooton.
He was good, too.
Very good. your acquaintance with apes is really remarkable, Mr. Hooton.
He just has morning classes.
I used to imitate myself when I saw
Also, there's a little story that David Garnett wrote some years ago called The Man
Lady
in the Zoo.
Lady in the Fox.
No, you got the wrong animal. Man in the Zoo. In which a man goes to live in an ape house in order to provide a good story for Mr. David Garnett to write. Now, up to this point, Lucky Strike announces a loss of $25 and one set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And now Mr. Cross has another news item this week. from below that imaginary line made famous by Messrs. Mason and Dixon.
Auction season closes in important tobacco market, might be the headline, Mr. Fadiman. For my news concerns the tobacco auctions which took place this fall at Greenville, North Carolina. All the big cigarette companies, the export companies, and the leaf buying companies were, of course, represented, and they did some lively bidding. Here are the final reports. As usual, the American Tobacco Company paid higher prices to get the finer, lighter, milder tobaccos. For the season at Greenville, we paid 55% more per pound for the tobacco we bought for our cigarettes and other tobacco products. Yes, 55% above the average market price paid for all the various types and grades of tobacco sold there. And the best we bought will go to Lucky's. Well, is it any wonder that independent tobacco experts smoke Lucky's 2-to-1? Every smoker who wants a cigarette of finer, lighter, naturally milder tobaccos might well profit by their example and ask for Lucky Strike.
Mr. Cross, you flashed across the finish line, according to my watch, in just 50 seconds. And now we'll start the second half of the program with a question coming to us from Miriam Gabriel of Ann Arbor, Michigan. Get 2 out of 3 if you can on this one. Why might you gentlemen choose not to spend the rest of your life at any of the following places? Why would you refuse to go there? The first place is Mauna Loa. How about that, Mr. Levant?
That's in Hawaii.
Yeah, what's happening there?
Well, it's like sitting on a hot seat, isn't it? That crater?
That's a nice way of putting it. Yes, it's an actual...
It's an erupting crater there.
Yes, on top of a practicing volcano. That's quite right, in Mauna Loa. Now, why would you prefer not to spend your life among the Battas of Sumatra? B-A-T-T-A-S, Mr. Hooton.
They have a nasty habit of hunting heads.
What do they do with them after they hunt them?
Well, they smoke them and put them away. And,
in a pipe, you mean?
No, they just sort of pickle them, put them up for trophies and so on. When a wife's, I think that's one of the places that when your husband dies, if you are a wife, you
don't look at me.
Hang his head around your neck and carry it around for a while.
Yes, they're very pleasant customers. Have you ever been among the Battas of Sumatra?
No, I...
That head you have is genuine, isn't it?
Not it smoked a bit.
With lucky strike. Now, why would you choose not to spend the rest of your life in Tibet? In Tibet. Mr. Hooten again.
Too cold.
Well, too cold in parts of it, yes. Any other reason? Can you think of?
What
if you were a man.
Defense?
I beg your pardon?
Well, I was through that before.
Mr. Kieran?
Well, one of the customs for the better class men, I believe, to shut themselves up in lamasaries and have nothing to do with the ladies.
You could read.
I do.
Well, it's something along that line. In Tibet, there's a scarcity of women. Why that should be so, I don't know. So that when a man marries, his brothers as well become the husbands of his wife. This is tough both on the brothers and the wife, it seems to me.
Well, that's no reason for not spending your life there.
I don't know. You mean share and share alike, Mr. Levant?
That changes the ratio. 3 can live as cheaply as 2.
Well, those are some of the reasons for not living the rest of your life in Tibet. How about
you mean that little girl in Ann Arbor didn't get a nickel?
Not a nickel on that one. You think that was a good question? Was a good question.
I think she ought to get some...
Oh, I'm sorry. You should have muffed the question then, Mr. Adams. May E. Frieda of Bay Village, Ohio, another little girl, Mr. Adams, sends in this question. Maybe we'll muff this one. In what musical compositions would you hear the bassoon solos that you're now going to listen to? They're going to be 3. Get 2 out of 3. Let's have the first. Thank you. Mr. Levant had his hand up at once.
It was very well played.
Thank you.
That's the opening of the Tchaikovsky Sixth.
It's the opening of the Tchaikovsky Sixth, the Pathetique.
All the Pathetique.
That's quite right. Is that a hard one to recognize, Mr. Levant?
No, I would say it was almost one of the easiest.
Well, now, do you want to have a harder one?
No.
Well, you've got it. Let's have the second. Thank you, Mr. Levant. See, that's easier, come to think of it. Thank you. That's a nice piece of...
Sure.
Kieran, do you recognize that, Miss Adams?
That might be the funeral march of a married man.
Not on your life. You just want to send that money to Miss Trevor. You probably know Mr. Adams and Mr. Levant.
It's in Dean Taylor's picture, Fantasia. Do call
him. Walt Disney's picture, too.
Well, he's not on our program, and Taylor is.
We may get him sometime. What's the piece called?
Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yes.
Sorcerer's Apprentice.
The Sorcerer's Apprentice. That's quite right.
By Paul Dukas.
By Paul Dukas. That's right. That gives us...
Never heard of him.
Have you seen Fantasia, Mr. Adams?
No.
Well, you should see it. Part of its musical, not all of its movies, so it's quite all right, even for you. How about the third and last of these bassoon solos? Mr. Levant? Mr. Kieran?
Scheherazade.
Scheherazade, that's quite right. Rimsky-Korsakov, thank you very much. Bassoon player. What does one call a bassoon player, Mr. Levant?
I forgot.
The Ancient Mariner.
Bassoonette?
Cornell Bassett, the George Bernard Shaw music critic name, remember?
No.
Cornell de Bassett.
Oh, yes, Cornell, that's right. Tell me, what is the function of the bassoon in an orchestra, Mr. Levant?
It's very important. It's a terribly flexible instrument, very agile, has a very wide range, has great dexterity, can be used melodically, humorously, rhythmically, and in conjunction with other woodwind or horn instruments.
Sometimes W and Y.
That's a perfect recitation. Thank you, Mr. Levant and Mr. Adams. Mr. A.R. Rappert of Minneapolis sends this one in. This is a question about generals, famous generals. Now, each of the following generals was famous for something other than being a general. What? Get 2 out of 3. The first general is Charles Gates Dawes. What was he famous for, Mr. Hooton?
He's famous for finance and for being vice president.
Yes, yes, that's right. When you say finance, you have reference to what? Particularly.
The Dawes Plan.
Thank you, Mr. Adams. The Dawes Plan, the after the war. Mr. Levant, Mr. Kieran.
Go ahead.
Well, he was famous for smoking an underslung pipe.
That's quite true, too.
He was a composer, thing. Which is what I was driving at.
Oh,
he had even pieces recorded. One piece called Melody, which I played the compliment for in a recording. And also, I think...
You've been in the darndest place.
Oh, no, he composed quite a lot.
He's also interested in archaeology, prehistoric archaeology.
Yes, and also famous for his... his language.
Why don't we get him on the show, the way he's
on? Very good. How about Augustus Henry Lane Fox Pitt Rivers? That's all I have. Augustus Henry Lane Fox Pitt Rivers. Mr. Hooton.
He's famous for archaeological excavations.
Yes, where, Mr. Hooton?
Cranbourne Chase and a lot of other places.
Very good. And he was a regular general in addition to all that.
All right.
Quite right. Now, how about... Very good. Thank you, Mr. Hooton. Now, how about Henry Martin Robert? Henry Martin Robert, who was a general and also famous, much more famous, for something else. Well, this is really a tough one. We have 2 out of 3. I'm going to tell you. Everybody who tries to run a meeting runs it according to the laws of
Robert's Rules of Order.
Thank you, Mr. Adams. He wrote the famous Rules of Order, and every chairman knows that book. General Roberts wrote the Rules of Order. One wrong, but that gets us by. Now, what can you do with this one? This comes from Ernest Schlonsky of St. Louis. What journey was taken by these characters in famous literary works? Get 2 out of 3. The first is a pair of characters, Jerry Cruncher and Jarvis Lorry. What journey was taken by them? Mr. Kieran.
Jerry Cruncher and Jarvis Lorry took the Dover Road. Jerry Cruncher in pursuit of Jarvis Lorry in The Tale of Two Cities.
That's right.
And Jerry Cruncher delivered the message, and the message was, recall to life.
That's right. I didn't expect the message, but I'm glad to get it. That's right. The Dover Road, of course, leading from where to?
Calais to Dover.
Yes.
Dover, that is leading to the port of...
yes, and eventually to Paris. I mean, they crossed the channel and went to Paris. Now, how about Dante and Virgil? What journey was taken by them? Mr. Hooton?
They went to the Inferno, the Hell, Hades, or whatever you want to call it. Huh?
Well, I'm not selecting the place. You are. Any other place?
I came back again.
They went through hell, that's true, but they also went through...
Little River?
Purgatory.
Purgatory, yes. Don't leave out
that's
Purgatory.
A mighty pretty country around there, too.
You must know, Mr. Adams. Where did all this happen, Mr. Hooton? Where did all this journeying take place?
In Italy.
Well, I mean, who wrote about it? In what book will you find it described?
Beatrice.
No, in what book, Mr. Hooton?
Divine Comedy.
Yes, Dante's Divine Comedy. Virgil, by the way, did not... guide Dante through paradise. Why didn't he?
He was a pagan.
Yes, he was not a Christian, and he was excluded from paradise. Now, how about Romeo? What journey was taken by Romeo? Mr. Kieran.
Why, he went to... when he left his bride, he fled to the city of what was it, Padua? Or what's the name of that city?
Well, let's see, if I tell you, then I get the question right, Mr. Jerry.
Verona?
That's right.
Verona.
To one, what was the other city? Verona to?
Well, the city where...
that's right.
Capulet and Montague.
You bet. That's right. What was it called, Mr. Levant?
Gee, I'll be sorry if I'm wrong. Was it Florence?
No, it wasn't. You just got it on your mind, that's all, Mr. Levant. It wasn't Florence. Mantua. Verona to Mantua. Well, that gives us 2.5 out of 3, thanks to Mr. Kieran's memory, which generally is infallible, and sends us on to this question from Henry Q. Humans of this city. Identify the following ladies. The Lady of the Lake, the Lady of the Chair, the Lady of Lloyd's, the Lady of the Lake. Mr. Kieran.
Well, the Lady of the Lake was the heroine of Scott's famous story.
Yes. How about the Lady of the Chair? Mr. Kieran?
The Lady of the Chair, isn't that the Madonna del Sedia, the painting?
Now, that sounds right.
Madonna del Sedia.
I wouldn't know. Also, isn't it a constellation?
Oh, Cassiopeia.
Cassiopeia,
chair.
Yes. And how about the Lady of Lloyd's?
Who's that lady you were talking about?
Cassiopeia.
The lady that you'll sometimes see in the evening, one of the constellations, a set of stars shaped more or less like a chair. Now, how about the Lady of Lloyd's? The Lady of Lloyd's. The Lady of Lloyd's was a fossil skull found in London in 1925. Well, that gives us 2 out of 3. And now, let's see.
I don't think it is a lady.
Mr. Cross has a question, and I think it's a rather interesting
one. How can a New England farmer, a Chicago housewife, and a New York debutante influence tobacco prices all over the South? Well, the answer is that, like most people across the land today, they want a mild cigarette. Each cigarette company naturally tries to give the farmer, the housewife, and the debutante what they want. So, inevitably, that old law of supply and demand takes effect at the auctions where tobacco is sold to the highest bidder. The finer, lighter, milder tobaccos go up in price. If you yourself were a tobacco expert, you'd see Lucky Strike paying $10 to $15 more per 100 pounds to get the milder tobaccos. These experts, who see what tobacco each company buys, know Lucky Strike goes after the finer, lighter leaf, and they smoke Luckies themselves by an overwhelming majority. Indeed, if you were a tobacco expert, the odds are 2 to 1 that you'd be a Lucky Strike smoker. For remember this, in buying tobacco, you get what you pay for, and Luckies pay the price to get the finer, lighter, naturally milder tobaccos.
Thank you, Mr. Cross. Lucky Strike's losses for this week are $25. That means one set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. A Lucky Strike thanks you, Dr. Hooton, for joining the party this evening. Next week, Mr. Kieran and Mr. Adams will be with us, and one of our guests is an old friend of Information Please, the noted American novelist, Louis Bromfield. As our second guest, we present that well-known star of movies and radio, currently appearing in The Letter, Mr. Herbert Marshall. Now remember, for every question we use, whether or not it's answered correctly, the sender gets $10. If the question stumps our experts, you not only get $25 more, but in addition, the complete 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Send letters with questions and correct answers to Information Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. And now a parting message from Mr. L.A. Speed Riggs, famous tobacco auctioneer of Goldsboro, North Carolina.
And that chant, fully interpreted, ladies and gentlemen, means Luckies pay higher prices for the finer, the lighter, the naturally milder tobaccos. With independent tobacco experts, auctioneers, buyers, warehousemen, with men who know tobacco best, it's Luckies 2 to 1.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.